If you're running a business right now, you're playing a game where the rules keep changing. Trade tensions, economic uncertainty, culture wars, the world is rapidly changing around us. And companies, especially independent and local businesses, are having to adapt faster than ever. That's why Mission Critical is evolving. We're diving deep with the founders, CEOs, and entrepreneurs who are navigating this chaos in real time. The ones making the tough calls, pushing through unpredictability, and proving that resilience isn't just a buzzword, it's a survival skill. How do you scale in an economy that feels like it's on shaky ground? What happens when US policy shifts send shockwaves through Canadian industries? And in a world where diversity, healthcare, and economic resilience are becoming battlegrounds, how do businesses double down instead of backing down? These are the real conversations that matter to business leaders right now. I'm Lance Chung, and this is Mission Critical. Let's get into it. Hi, David. How's it going?
Good. Excellent, but good.
I'm so excited for our chat. Where are you zooming in from today?
I am zooming in from my brand new apartment that we slept in for the first time last night.
Okay. Congratulations. We are
indebted homeowners, me and my partner. but this is the situation, so you can get a visual.
Love. Yeah. Yep. Been there. I understand. Well, I appreciate you hopping on a call in the middle of your move, because I know that a move can be so disruptive. I really, really appreciate you hopping on a call.
It's all good. It's all good.
So I'm excited about our chat because, you know, I grew up in a Korean kitchen, Korean household, and as someone who grew up eating fermented food and it playing such a huge role in the kitchen growing up, it's something that I feel like the world has relatively recently, or I guess maybe like from like a Western culture standpoint, really grown to like appreciate and embrace. But it wasn't always something that I felt was the case growing up with, you know, kimchi and fermented food and just in general. So this is an exciting chat, and I'm really looking forward to it. You know, you've often framed food as really like something bigger than what's on our plates, obviously, something that's reflective of who we are and where we're going. And, you know, food, as we all know, really sits at this incredibly interesting intersection of so many different systems, whether that's like climate or culture or economics and health. Like, it is really such a wonderful barometer and reflection of the larger dialogue that we're having in culture. From your perspective, what does our relationship with food say about the world that we've created and the one that we want next?
That's a big... I thought you said this was going to be a casual question.
Just starting off right at the top.
Top notch.
Yeah.
What does our relationship to food say about where we are and where we're going? You know, in your question, you say that food sits at the intersection of all these different facets of human life and the human endeavor. And I really think, like, how could it be otherwise? Mm-hmm. Eating is the one thing life has to do beyond replicating to be alive. What's it called? The three F's. Feeding, fighting, and the other one. That's how biologists talk about the essentials of living. Keeping yourself alive in all those ways, and your progeny, I suppose.
Yeah.
Food, feeding yourself, whether you're a microbe, whether you're a man, a woman, it's fundamental to existence. Food is shaped by the climates. Food is other organisms in your environment. It is your environment. Food is the basis for economic systems. The first forms of currency were grains and salt. Food is culture. Because think about how much time before the advent of modern agriculture or fast food and commoditized ingredients Think about how much time it would take your Korean great-grandparents to pull glass noodles, or a grandmother in Italy to make raviolis or tortellinis by hand. Those moments around the table, the moments in the field as a farmer, those are the actions and the energy that create culture. So no wonder that food is so central to it.
Yeah, things that we inherit.
Exactly, exactly. So when I think about food and when I think about what it is to us, I see it through that lens. I see it as the most essential form of the most essential endeavor, and what it means to be alive is to eat. And you might as well enjoy it. I think one of the biggest affronts to me are these brands like Huel or Soylent that create food for people who despise eating. I'm like, then what joy is there in being alive? You know, like Priyat Savarin said, you know, tell me what you eat and I'll tell you what you are. I don't know what you are if you eat engineered gray liquid void slop. Like, I just don't know. I don't know. You want to be a machine? You know what that looks like? It looks like the androids, like the synths.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
an alien. Like, their blood is like.
Yes.
Baby. Yeah. That's what you are if you want to eat Soylent for breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
It's really interesting, like, yeah, what that says about a people based off of how they approach the act of like eating and consuming and food in general. I, you know, it's something that like I talk about with my friends sometimes is like for us, it's like the barometer of like who we love to associate is really directly tied to how they like to eat, to be honest. Yeah. And like some people that we've met, and like some people I've even gone on dates with in the past, I remember have said like, I don't really eat for pleasure. I just eat for function. I'm like, that is not going to work for me. So it's so interesting how what that says about a person and about a people in terms of how they approach food, and also everything that orbits around that in terms of like, also then by extension, how do people come together at the table? How do they not come together in culture, or how do they view something like breaking bread? And how does that relate to kind of like value systems, right?
Yeah. So to answer the second part of your question, riffing off that, you know, I think that Soylent is a good segue into like, well, where are we and how did we get here and what do we want to become? And, you know, I think like when you talk about values, I think about someone with a bottle of Soylent as their When I think about someone with a bottle of Soylent, you know, consuming it, drinking it, chewing it, maybe as their like power lunch, so that they can get back to productivity in whatever way, shape, or form that occupies their life, whatever that means to them, you know, hammering out the next line of code or like finishing the next PowerPoint presentation or writing the next report or pitch, whatever. It really kind of inverts value for me. I'm like, you only care about making money, but not what money buys. You know, money.
Right.
Money in some way, shape, or form can buy you freedom, but like, you know, no amount of money ever bought a second of time. And when I think about the time it takes to make food, and when you don't see that as a loss, and it's like, oh, that's wasted money. If time is money, then spending 5 hours in the kitchen making ravioli with my wife and my children, sitting around the table folding dumplings, that's a waste of time. But is it? Or is it like the most fundamental way of joining other humans, of partaking in this labor of love? I wrote a little, this reminds me of an Instagram post I wrote years back about making agnolotti. And I compared it to something in evolutionary biology, a term called maladaptive, a maladaptive practice, which is something that an animal might do that decreases its fitness. So for example, there's this fruit in the Congo that is nutritionally very poor. So the tree that produces it doesn't have to like pump sugar into it to attract specifically gorillas. It produces like a stevia-like compound that tricks gorillas into thinking it's sweet, which is much cheaper for the plant to produce than sugar is. Like, sugar is a real cost to a plant. That is pure photosynthetic work, right? But if you can make this little cheat molecule that binds to a gorilla's sweet receptors for like a fraction of the metabolic cost, you can get the gorillas to come and like gorge on the fruit that is nutritionally poor and take it away and spread your seed. It's a cheat, if you will. That in biology is called a maladaptive practice. The little addendum to that story is that there are diverging populations of gorillas in Africa who have evolved in an arms race to detect, to like lose that sense of taste so that they can identify that it's like not nutritionally.
Right.
Like
nutritionally dense or like, fruits,
you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway,
when you think about the amount of labor it takes to make like kneading the dough, getting your filling ready, braising it overnight, for how small it is, you know, and in one bite it's gone. I guarantee that you have expended more energy producing that ravioli than that ravioli contains. But that's exactly the point. It's maladaptive. It's a maladaptive behavior only up until you realize what those forms of food making, crafting, consuming do for humans. They provide the social glue that makes us who we are. So when you wanted to talk about like food in this lens, that's what I think of. I think of food as the thing that binds us to each other and deserves to have time spent on. And when you think that it's like, it can be one of the most pleasurable experiences that is above board that you can get in life on a daily basis, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Why not give it the time it deserves?
Well, and also it's like about the process too, and like enjoying that part, not just the end result, and how we are able to bond with our family or, you know, have intergenerational kind of like traditions mm-hmm. as a result of that process and the time that it takes to invest in that process. Whether it's, you know, me sitting at a kitchen counter with my grandma and like making kimchi in these like giant steel bowls and stuff, and like that taking like an entire day or whatever it might be. It's not always just about the end result too, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
exactly. It's not the destination.
100%
journey.
Yeah, you know, looking at your career path, you know, from Noma to biotech to television, what do you think has been the common thread that has really driven your curiosity across any kind of endeavor that you take?
Yeah, I guess, you know, it's really funny, but just before this, I actually had an interview with NPR, and my interviewer talked to me about her own curious driver. And she realized it was the aha moment, or like her husband realized it for her. She's like, I think I like nonfiction. And then her husband was like, I think you like learning. And I think that's what it is for me. There is this deeply inimitable satisfaction from the aha moment where you read something or you figure something out or you realize that two things are connected in a way that you couldn't see before you spent the time to figure out how it works. That gives you like an explanatory power, that gives you the ability to describe the world more accurately or explain things that seemed inexplicable before. And that every time I have one of those aha moments of like, oh, so that's how that works, or that's how that effect comes about. You know, it's like a drug. It's like a kick. Yeah. And that has that hunger for that kick, I think, has driven me, in combination with maybe a little bit of adventurousness or like a, you know, I'm the black sheep of my family. I moved out when I was 18 and never looked back. You know, it made for like a dangerous cocktail of like constantly wanting to seek out new experiences that would give me that kick. And so that's what led me to Noma. That's what led me to, you know, I just moved in and I had to install like one of the big things about moving in was like that the bookshelf gets a bigger room so I could install more shelves for all the books that were spilling off my already massive bookshelf. Yeah. That's been the driver for me. And I've also, you know, never had a plan. I just put one foot in front of the other. And for example, when the bioscience gig came up, when a company, which was at the time called Christian Hansen, reached out to me at Noma to collaborate on a project, and I told them that I already handed them my notice. You know, that door opening where they're like, oh, well, come and see us. We'll have a chat. Maybe this could turn into something interesting. Yeah. I was like, why wouldn't I want to take this job? Why wouldn't I want to see the side of food production and use what I know? But then also, like, without a doubt, not be the smartest person in a room in any given day and be able to, like, chat with a microbiologist or, like, chat with, like, a mycologist or, you know, chat with someone who specializes in enzymes or specializes in process development.
It's that journey of, like, of learning.
Exactly.
And yeah.
That's really fun. Yeah.
You know, with regards to the world that you live in, you know, fermentation is really like this invisible kind of collaboration between living things, at least invisible to like kind of like our naked eye. What has living and operating and leading in this world taught you about how we collaborate as humans, and also maybe like our misunderstanding about how collaboration and progress actually happens, whether that's in a kitchen or in a lab or a company?
The longer I live, the more I realize that nothing is all good and nothing is all bad.
We don't live in a binary.
Absolutely not. Everything's blurry as hell.
Yeah.
The boundaries in between what you think is like contamination or inoculum, what you wanted to be there, what you didn't, for example, that's blurry. The dichotomy, like, you know, the ends of the pendulum between a symbiont in your gut and a pathogen, that can be the same organism, you know, on different days. You know, it's not one or the other. You know, a pest is only a pest until you kick it out of your house. And I just co-authored this paper that just published in iScience. Came out a few days ago. My fellow researchers, you know, blew open the microbiome of ants and realized that they held the bacteria responsible for sourdough bread in their guts. You know, that's like a relevant, timely example. But when you think about, oh, well, where do the bacteria that make sourdough bread come from? And you see ants in your kitchen rummaging through your grain drawer. You're like, never look at them the same way again. You know, so when I think about collaboration and when I think about collaboration, almost precludes the idea that whatever you're doing together is some sort of a positive to the parties involved. Like, no one thinks that the gazelle is collaborating with the leopard that it's running away from.
Right.
But that is a form of symbiosis. Predator-prey relationships are a form of symbiosis. You know, the pathogens in your gut that aren't making you sick necessarily, but are there nonetheless waiting for an opportunity to give you a candida infection or a C. difficile infection. That is also a form of symbiosis. And so, you know, when I think about collaboration in nature and I think about collaboration in food and fermentation, I see it in a very nuanced way where I know that the things that we want also come with things that we don't want. And that is an inescapable truth of the world. Boundaries are blurry and things are not just one thing ever anywhere.
It's not so black and white.
Yeah, no, not at all. It's all muddy and it's all gray. And it becomes fermentation as a way of kind of blowing open your worldview when you dig into it and understand its machinations and study it. Because you come across these nuggets of knowledge and you're like, wait, well, that's weird. You're like, oh, I thought that E. coli outbreaks are bad. What do you mean it's living in my gut? What do you mean it's supposed to be there? Then you learn about how that happens. The ways in which modern industrial food systems engender this switch, this flip, this tipping point between something that is a normal member of a microbial community turning into something that can wreak havoc. And yeah, getting back to your
challenging question. Like our worldviews of what, you know, right and wrong, yes and no. Like, yeah, it's not quite that simple. Life is not that simple. The world doesn't really operate that way.
No, not at all.
I read in one of your past interviews, you say, quote, you cannot have fermentation without an act of generosity. Can you unpack kind of what that means and how that's, you know, still relevant to what just today and like the world we live in today?
Mm-hmm. Aristotle thought that life sprang from inanimate matter, that if you like left a bunch of rags in a corner for long enough, eventually mice would spring out of it. That's because people like weren't paying enough attention to understand that there was like a mother mouse that thought it would make a good nest and had her little pinkies in it. And then, you know, but the ancients thought that like, that God made people and everything else just kind of caught a breath of vivified air and became alive. And then Pasteur famously rose to prominence because he refuted that. He developed the germ theory of microbiology. He developed the entire field of microbiology through tests that proved that microbes had to come from somewhere. And all of his studies, you know, there's this famous swan neck experiment, but all of his studies were based on his work in fermentation. Working in a small French town where he was studying the problems of the French beer and wine industry and vinegar makers, trying to understand why their ferments would go bad sometimes. And those were the teachings that allowed him to revolutionize medicine and the modern world and food, for better or worse. So that just goes to show you, like Pasteur did, that like all life comes from life. It is the dream of every cell to become two cells. And that's true in fermentation too. It's like if you have a kombucha going on your counter, if you're making your lemon jasmine black tea kombucha and you let it go long enough, you're going to end up with a mother where 2 has become 4, has become 8, has become 16, has become 32 ad infinitum. A mother so thick that you have to chop it up to keep the process going. And what do you do with the rest? You give it to someone else. Mm-hmm. You know, a friend of mine who has a small, like, non-alcoholic brewery here in Copenhagen was like, hey, Dave, do you have any, like, kefir grains? I really need some kefir grains. I'm like, yeah, I can hook you up. The amount of people who've been like, hey, could I get some koji spores off of you? And could you teach me how to propagate them afterwards so that I could harvest them? And, like, you cannot ferment without giving it away. It's not made for one person. It's made for communities. And yet, going back, it binds communities. Kimjang festivals, you know what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
These are the things that like bring people together. And then they can go apart afterwards and take those products with them. And then spread them wherever they are. That's the history of food traveling through the world.
And even like outside of bringing people together in a place and time, but also across time, like across generation too, it is bringing generations together through just this inherited kind of, or passing down of, you know, knowledge and also just like quite literal, like cultures and, you know, whether it's a starter or a mother or whatever it might be, like it is through time as well, which is such an interesting thing to kind of explore and think about, I think. You know, it feels like, you know, there's kind of like a level of surrender required in fermentation, in that it's, you know, you can guide it, but you can't fully like control it. How do you personally navigate that tension between control and trust in your own creative and professional life? Where do those things show up?
Oof. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. To talk about it in terms of fermentation, I mean, I think one of the most fascinating things about the craft and the art and the science, if it can be all those three things at once, or maybe I think if I am like an expert, someone called me an expert today. They're like, oh, this is the fermentation expert, David Zilber. If I am an expert, I think I really credit my time at NOMA for A, having to be so experimental, B, having to not just come up with an idea and prove that it was possible once. Like that paper that I was talking about, the yogurt that we made like a jar of it and like took out some curds and said like, look, we did it. And then you get to publish a paper. Like that's how science is. You're like, can you do it once? Can you do it twice? Great. Here's your article in the press. In a restaurant, when you ferment, you have to do it like 1,000 times a week. And it has to be replicable, you know. And the funny thing is that when I was fermenting at NOMA, and you were pushing the boundaries and getting microbes to do things that they wouldn't normally want to do, you also had to wrestle with the fact that sometimes that will go wrong, that it's not up to you, that you can be the shepherd, but you are not the sheep. And the sheep can have minds of their own. And you can have a disobedient sheep in a flock, and it can go into a neighbor's field or get caught in the brambles, and it can just run away from you, you know? And that had to also just coexist with the fact that working at what was then the world's best restaurant, you had to just expect that everything had to be perfect all the time. Mm-hmm. Like Renee demanded it. And to be fair, Michelin inspectors demand it, that it is consistent and precise and exact. So that's a big square peg round hole moment when you think about it for more than 2 seconds.
Right, right.
And that is exactly right. It requires surrender. To understand that you are trying to coax nature into doing things it might not normally want to do of its own accord. And you learn to intuit the kind of mechanisms and the needs of microbes that can't speak to you. They're like, oh, was it a little bit too much sugar? Oh, was it a little bit too wet? Was it too much starch? Was it not enough time? Was it too hot? Was it too cold? Was it too dry? And I credit the repetitions that I had to put in into, you know, providing these products, not just coming up with them and inventing them, but producing them and being in charge of production.
Yeah.
You know, making 500 moldy egg yolks every week, for helping me to understand all these alternate paths the microbes might want to take and the reasons for that wanting. And there are times where it went wrong and we had to take things off the menu, and that's the surrender. You just have to accept that it's not up to you. And you have to be humble about it, and you can't fake it. And the other thing is, it just takes time. So when things go wrong, I remember I had an intern running around my lab at NOMA. He'd come from Alinea in the States. He was like, I think he came from like a military family, so he was kind of like hardcore. And he was like whipping around in the lab one day, like really like gunning to get the prep list done. And he like knocked something over. I'm like, Ian, just slow down, man. Just stop before anything else goes wrong. Can I swear on this podcast?
Oh, yeah. You can say whatever you like.
If we are so in the shit that you need to run around like a headless chicken, we fucked up 3 months ago. You know, like there is nothing in this laboratory that needs to happen that fast. And I know that's weird to say from a sous chef in a 3-Michelin-star restaurant, but it's true. Like this is a different speed in here. So you just have to surrender, because the problem can't be fixed like a bad knife cut or an overcooked steak. You know, you can't just say refire that on the double. It's not, you can't make the microbes work faster. You can't. It's not up to you.
I think that's a really interesting, thing to think about and kind of unpack about that relationship between, you know, as you say, surrender, but also symbiosis, and how those things like kind of work and oscillate in tandem with each other and are not necessarily like always at odds with each other, but it is just this natural part of the same conversation of the same circle and how they relate to each other, and also how they relate to our lives and being able to understand like when you need to surrender in certain instances and when you can't control a situation, or a situation does not want to be tamed in the way that you want to tame it, and when you can have this symbiotic kind of relationship with a scenario or something and work with your people. And I don't know, it's just, I feel like those two things are kind of interesting themes to explore, but and how they relate to each other in our lives.
Yeah.
What excites you most about how we can redesign food systems to be more symbiotic, not just sustainable, but also generative and more symbiotic?
I know what has to happen. I don't know if it will happen, but I know what that looks like, and it's just decentralized. It's more power to the people. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's my friend from Detroit who was just visiting, who I had pizza with the other night, who works on giving Detroit residents like the tools to have their own urban farms or turn their backyards into nurseries. You know, that's what that looks like. That's what heals the world. It's also funny that I work for a giant biotech company that is very much a centralized seat of power in the world of fermentation, that has a huge chunk of the market cornered on the bacteria responsible for yeast and sausages and pepperoni and yogurt and cheese. At the same time, you know, I'm not naive enough to think that the way that the world is now can be like wished away with the best intentions. And so I really do feel that there's value in the work I get to do at a company like Novonesis, where I can make an ingredient labeled more natural using microbes, or I can take out a preservative or a colorant using microbes, or make truly delicious plant-based products that don't have, you know, 101 E numbers on them, using microbes. And that helps to, in a small way, get at what you're talking about in this industrial food system that is blind to borders, is blind to origins, treats food like indefinite forever lasting commodities. It's so weird to me that like you can have a futures market for tomatoes. I'm like, go talk to a tomato farmer about like go talk to someone with like a greenhouse making like growing heirloom tomatoes about how much sense it makes to fix a price for next year's crop. You know, you can only do that when things get so big and so out of control large that it almost becomes like abstract. On the ground, you would never talk about a growing season that way. You know, you'll be like, well, we'll see what the weather brings next year.
Yeah, from a pragmatic, practical sense, for sure. Yeah.
So there's, you know, more than half of the world's population, more than 4 billion people live in cities. There are less people working in agriculture than there's ever been at any point in history. 125 years ago in the US, it was like 30 to 40% of the US workforce, labor force, worked in food production or in agriculture. Now it's like less than two. It's like 1.65 or something. That's wild that it takes so few people to feed so many people.
Yeah, yeah.
And if you've ever spent a day on a farm, you know how much work it takes to make food, or a day in the kitchen at any point along, at any juncture in the food chain. If you have been a laborer, you know how precious food is. So to me, it's wild that it can take so little to produce so much.
Yeah. I guess building on that, do you think that there, like from your perspective and your experience and the work that you're doing today, what do you think is a misconception that is still commonly held with kind of the general public around food systems and also just like the role that microbes play in the conversation around fermentation?
I mean, I definitely think that the vibe check has been shifting on this for quite some time, but like they're not all germs. And there are still some people that, you know, have an ick factor when it comes to like, oh, what's my, like, ew, natto? Oh, disgusting. But generally I've, you know, over the course of my own life, I grew up with a mom that like used to like practically doused the chicken in Lysol. Like she came from the Caribbean, you know, like she wasn't cooking chicken unless it had been like soaked in salt, bathed in vinegar, squeezed with lime juice, then cooked until it was like 10 past done. I think that the war on germs has let up slightly and that we are starting to understand that they're not all bad actors. When you see like doctors on like evening news being like, let your kid play in the dirt. So what if they eat a little? So what if they put a bug in their mouth? It'll help their immune system. And when you realize that that's backed by like real science that proves that there's all these, you know, causal correlations between hygienicism and autoimmune disease, because we've taken ourselves out of contact with nature and out of contact with germs. When you see the results of studies that are like eating 3 servings of fermented food improves like all sorts of biomarkers when it comes to human health. You know, it's, I think that the misconceptions are kind of evaporating from this rising tide of research and enthusiasm and practitioners for sure. That are all driving the conversation forward.
Yeah. Yeah. Switching gears a little bit, you know, you've lived and worked in multiple countries and contexts and cultures. How has that shaped the way you think about your work?
Yeah, I've traveled a lot. I think the more you see, the more you know. I love being exposed to different things. I love going somewhere and being like, oh, what's in your cellar? How do you make this? I think that, you know, in that way, like cultural evolution is as remarkable as like biological evolution. That you can have peacocks and parrots and cassowaries and chickens all in the same family of animals. And you can get that same variety from food and especially fermentation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can have fermented reindeer blood in northern Finland, and you can have, you know, stinky, smelly cheese feet beans, you know, on the west of the African coast. There's so much out there. But I also think that the most fascinating part of all of those travels is picking out the similarities between very different things. And to make another analogy to biological evolution, you know, there was Tasmanian tigers and then there's real tigers, or there were. There are, what's another really good example? There are possums and then there are opossums.
Right.
Like evolution has a way of making itself rhyme, and that's called conversion evolution. And the same thing happens in food and fermentation as well. Like I remember partaking in this one book that like an anthology that Chris Ying did for NOMA, or for MAD rather, some years ago, called You and I Eat the Same. One of my favorite articles is like, every culture has like a flatbread with stuff on top. Or like every culture has like some version of like rice and peas.
And or like a dumpling.
Yeah, exactly. My girlfriend calls them all pierogies. I showed her a beef patty the first time I took her to Toronto. She's like, that's a weird looking pierogi. I'm like, not a pierogi. She's like, pastry, meat inside.
Yeah.
Well, this one's not boiled. Ooh. I'm like, not a pierogi. But it's true, you know, so humans are good at convergently evolving. As diverse as our foods are, the same concepts, because they're good concepts. And I think that like when you travel enough and can come to those conclusions on your own, you have a little aha moment that shows you just how amazing gastronomy can be.
Yeah.
And human ingenuity too.
Building on that, so, you know, as someone who spent years in, you know, experimental kitchens, and now you sit on the other side of the table as a judge on Top Chef Canada, how do you approach judging something like creativity? What's your approach to that?
You know it when you see something with flair. I don't know. It becomes like an intuition to be able to spot like true creativity. And it's also context dependent. I mean, something that like one contestant can make that in another season might've blown you away can be outshone by someone who like really pulled a rabbit out of their hat. And you're like, oh yeah, that was nice. But check out Jenny's cassoulet. Wow. Never thought to do that, you know?
Right.
Whatever it might be. But you also have to, like, I approach it the same way that I approach eating out or going to someone else's house for dinner. And like, sometimes people would be like, oh, I'm afraid to cook for you. You've like worked at NOMA. Like you've worked at like 3-star restaurants. And I'm like, again, it's context dependent. I'm like, I don't expect you to cook me a 3-star meal. And I'm just happy to be here eating your food. It's about being here with you, not about like comparing you to the best meal I've ever had at Bennu in San Francisco. That's not the point. You know, I have to eat 3 meals a day. They can't all be the best meal of my life, nor should they.
And would you want them to be?
Exactly, right?
Yeah.
You'd be exhausted.
Yeah, totally. You'd
be exhausted. So judging the food is kind of like that too. Like,
yeah, I think that's your approach.
Also fantastic and amazing to just see what these cooks can whip up, to see them pour their heart into it. And again, on any given day, you can be so proud of a contestant that you've watched shine or strive or push, present something that's like ostensibly simple. Maybe it's like, yeah, maybe it's like a bean stew. Maybe it's like a stir fry. Maybe it's like a quick fry challenge and it's like a takeout box of fried rice, but they just nail how it comes together, or that one little like that one little touch of creativity or ingenuity that shows that they're thinking, you know, 2 steps ahead.
Yeah.
And you give them points for that.
The contestants, you know, are obviously learning from the judging panel and learning from the experience, you know, about their craft. I'm curious, has your experience on the show, like, have you learned anything from the contestants on the show and the experience on the show that has kind of like, you know, changed the way you think about a specific dish or how you think about just food in general? Like, what have you taken from the experience yourself?
It's so hard for me to convey to regular watchers of Top Chef. Like, it can be campy. You know, the editing is fast. It's a reality show. I get it. It's TV. It's meant to be entertaining. It's designed to be entertaining. I can't tell you how real it is. It is a real fucking cooking competition. Mm-hmm. I would not want to be on the other side of the judges' table sometimes. I have to be in those challenges. Because, like, I got jobs, but it's hard. It is legit hard. It's real. It's as real as it gets. So of course I learn stuff from all these contestants because they're going through something that I wouldn't want to go through myself, to be honest.
Yeah, fair.
And when they make magic happen, it's like legit impressive. I'm like, how did you do that? And then they tell me and I'm like, well, cool. Good idea.
I love that.
Yeah. So, you know, it reminds me of my very first day in culinary school. I was like 18 years old. I was actually still in high school. And my teacher like greets the class and he's like, I am your teacher, but I am also a student. And we're like, what? And he's like, I have something to learn from all of you. And then like one of like this loud girl in the class, it's probably from Scarborough, like, man, you're the teacher. What do you mean? You're supposed to teach us. And he's like, but I have something to learn from every encounter I have in the kitchen, from everyone. I don't know what I don't know. Maybe one of you has a way of butchering a chicken that you learned from your mom that's different from how I do it. Yeah. Maybe you're going to show me something that I've never tasted before. Maybe you're going to just have, you know, a little spark and say, what if we did it this way? And it'll actually be a good idea. He's like, I have something to learn from everyone. And it's true. You do.
Yeah. And so, everyone's lived experiences ultimately contribute to their work in different ways. And yeah, there's something beautiful about being a teacher and a student at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just as we round out here, you know, if fermentation can be used as a metaphor for something like transformation, where do you feel like you are in your own transformation for yourself?
Like I said, a lot of my life has just been putting one foot in front of the other and just fall upwards, fail forward, learn, make your mistakes quickly. I don't know. I feel like I'm older. I feel like I've made a lot of mistakes in my life, and I feel like I have an enormous amount of opportunities that come my way, and I'm extremely fortunate for that. I remember when I was going to Noma and I asked my dad for a little bit of help with like the plane ticket or maybe like the Airbnb because I was there for a month for my interview. And I framed it to him and he's like, I'm like, look, like you've never had to do much for me since I left the house. And I know that like I'm just a cook and Rochelle, my sister, has like a master's degree in immunology. I'm like, but you paid for her whole education because you thought it was worth it. I'm like, if I do this right and I make it into Noma, this will be the last time I ever have to send someone my resume. He's like, all right, okay, good point. And to be fair, it's true. That has happened.
I love that.
And now post Noma, you know, in my career, in my own life, I mean, I've become a father in the past few years. Finally bought a house, become a homeowner because I've saved and I've been able to, thanks to the work that I do, and like be paid for my knowledge and experience. I don't know what's next. I want to age gracefully, but also crazily. Like I want to be the old man with like gray hair and braids or dreads who like goes to the coffee shop in slippers and a robe. So then like everyone knows him and like you're like, that man is homeless, and then someone sparks a conversation. I'm like, actually I was at the UN last week and you know I really think that there's a culture shift around UNESCO's work in Africa. Like that's who I am. And that's exactly who I want to be.
And those and people you know have lived a life, a good life.
I have lived a lot of life. I will say I have done some shit.
Yeah.
I forget all of the things I have done. And someone's like, oh, I met you in Africa. Or it's like, don't you remember that you introduced me to this professor that is now like, and now I have a PhD. I'm like, I don't remember that. But if you say so, I believe it. Sounds like something I would do. So I just want to keep doing that. I just want to keep putting one foot in front of the other and working with great people and discovering weird things and letting microbes change how I think about the world and turning me into them.
I love that. I love that. What a great way to cap off our interview. If you have a few minutes, I'd love to just do like a quick fun little rapid fire.
Rapid fire. Shoot. Rapid I'm fire. Also sorry that I'm in the dark, but there's no light in this part of the house yet.
Oh, okay. I was just about to ask if you would be able to adjust your lens, but
there's no light.
It looks like one of those interrogation videos on True Crime. Where
the recorder is like,
yeah.
I looked at Enron when the CEO was.
Yeah. All good. Okay, rapid fire. What's one dish that changed the way you think about food?
Hans jerk tteokbokki. I think Han made a jerk tteokbokki like last season, and I'm like, bruh, this is on another level. It was additional. I think about that all the time.
Yeah.
I think about that jerk tteokbokki all the time. Like Jamaican Korean, okay. And it was like one of the tastiest dishes I've ever had.
That sounds incredible.
No, was it tteokbokki? It was either tteokbokki or mapo tofu. It might have been jerk mapo tofu. I can't remember.
Were there rice cakes in it?
I can't remember.
It was
really good though.
Okay. Is there a culinary rule that you love to consistently break?
Soy sauce is good in everything. Everything. It doesn't mean that everything should be like soy butter chicken or like soy beurre blanc, but like if you know how to use it in the right quantities, like a subliminal message, soy sauce is good in everything.
Is there a song or artist that is always on like your cooking soundtrack, or do you prefer to work in silence?
You know what I was listening to today that I was just had on repeat?
What's that?
La Bicifre.
Okay. I
had La Bicifre on in the lab today. It was great.
Do you have a comfort food that you go to after like a long day in the lab?
My favorite, I just want to eat a good meal dish is like a fresh pasta, like a maccheroni with Italian sausage and like charred rapini.
Yum.
Like no tomatoes, like aglio, just is good. It's and peperoncino and cheese.
Oh yes.
My God, I'll do that tonight, but I don't have a pasta.
What's the secret to impressing you as a judge on Top Chef Canada?
It's a bit of a star diagram. Mm-hmm. So you can like be full on in one and be at zero in the other, and you'd still like, okay, credit. Cleverness, intelligence, like deft technique, like perfectly sharp technique. Spice and contextuality.
Yeah. What's the most common mistake that contestants make under pressure that you've seen?
Not being able to self-edit.
Is there a food trend that you wish would go extinct?
Yeah, what is matcha? Why is there's like a matcha shortage because like everything needs to be green now.
There's literally a matcha cafe opening up down the street from where I live.
But I've even like I read articles from like matcha growers in like Japan who are like, stop it. Stop consuming all is you're like messing up the matcha supply chain. Like we can't grow anymore. And now there's all this like dubious, like we don't have to make everything a thing all the time.
It's not
even being done properly. They're just like putting it in a blender and you're like, this was a ceremony once.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Is there a food trend that you secretly love?
That I'm aware of? No. That I'm like, I am for the trend of like affordable food being really good and getting better. Yeah, no.
What's the most exciting food city to, or exciting city to eat in right now?
In the world?
Yeah, like just in your experience, in your travels, like what do you think is like the place?
I really want to go back and eat through London again. I haven't been there in a few years. And I'm like, there's stuff going on. There's like, and it's not even like the fancy restaurants. It's like, it's like just get a place for lunch. Or it's like, go out and like spend like 100 quid. Like those sorts of joints. And there's like, so like the list in London, I'm just like, every time I'm on Instagram, I'm like, where is this place? I'm like, what? I'm like, I got to put that down. Yeah, London, I would say. I want to get back to.
Last one here. What do you think is a dish that best represents your experience of Toronto?
Jamaican patty cocoa bun.
Love it. Love it.
And a champagne cola.
Cola, I love it. Love it. David, thank you so much for your time and this wonderful chat and perspective and insight. I've loved just having this conversation and just listening to you just talk about this incredible world that you exist and live and work in. So I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It has been a welcome distraction from unpacking and navigating the painters that are a week behind schedule. But yeah.
Oh my gosh. Well, best of luck on the unpacking and the rest of the move. And again, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
That's a wrap on this episode of Mission Critical. If today's conversation gave you something to think about, do me a favor. Subscribe, leave a review, and share it with someone who needs to hear it. Big ideas are meant to be shared, and the best insights only matter if they're put into action. Until next time, stay sharp, stay curious, and go and make something happen. I'm Lance Chung, and this is Mission Critical.